Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Irma Muniz. Irma is the wife of Ramzi Muniz. Ramzi is one of many political prisoners in America. His case is one that really stands out for me because of the kind of person he is and because of his character and his effective activism. He was targeted, not for any crime he committed, and he's now serving a life sentence without parole unless he's commuted. He's been in prison for nearly 17 years. His activism for Latino rights and empowerment was really heroic, and that's the reason that authorities targeted him. It got him framed, got him incarcerated for life without parole. Just another shocking example of the kind of injustice here in this country. Before I introduce Irma and we get into a discussion about Ramzi and his case and his status, let me just mention that I write often on political prisoners in the country. Oh, I've written on 30 or 40 of them. I've yet to run across a single person I've written about who's guilty of any crime. Most of them are ordinary people. They're activists. So many are Muslims. They're blacks. They're Latinos. They're people involved with defending the environment, fighting for animal rights. People in the last two categories are called one of the terms we come up with in this country to really corrupt the language and really defile the kind of people that they're talking about. We talk about eco-terrorists. This was a term that came out of the 2001 USA Patriot Act that came up with the crime of domestic terrorism committed by U.S. citizens for the first time. We've always had domestic terrorism committed by non-U.S. citizens. But now we can charge U.S. citizens with domestic terrorism. It's part of the hype to scare people, the so-called war on terror, terrorists in our midst. So when in doubt and you want to target somebody, you can, it's the catch-all when there is nothing else to charge them with. You charge them with being a terrorist. Just a word about our prison system, and then we'll get into Ramzi's case. One of the first articles I ever wrote, the title was The U.S. Gulag Prison System, and I was not talking about the one abroad. I was talking about the one right here in America. My subtitle was The Shame of the Nation. Indeed, it should be The Shame of the Nation. But how many people know about it? There's never a word about this in any report in so-called mainstream news, whether we're talking about the CNNs or the CBSs or the Fox News, NBC, the New York Times. Maybe the New York Times would have something, but never a feature story, maybe something on a back page that nobody ever reads. So nobody knows about this, but there's somewhere on the order of, we have the largest prison population in the world by far. We have a larger population than China, and China has four times our population. Somewhere on the order of 2.4 million prisoners held in federal and state facilities, local jails, Indian, juvenile, military ones, U.S. territories, numbers held by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Unit, so-called ICE. They're holding mostly undocumented Latinos, mostly from Mexico, also Central America. And why do they come here? They don't come here because they want to come here, because they don't like their countries. They come here because destructive trade agreements like NAFTA destroy their lives, their livelihoods. If they want their families to eat, they need a source of income. If there's nothing for them at home, and most of them were related to agriculture, well, U.S. agriculture destroyed agriculture in countries like Mexico. So they're forced to come here, not because they want to. And we call them criminals. The criminals are the people in Congress and the people in the Clinton administration and others that passed destructive trade laws. Talk about a weapon of mass destruction. That's a real one, NAFTA. And there are others, CAFTA, affecting Central America, and other hideous trade agreements, some of them bilateral ones. So a lot of those people, they're put in prisons before they're deported, and they're treated horrifically. I've written about that several times, and the way they're treated. But the others, most of them are in prison for nonviolent offenses. Half of those are drug-related. They shouldn't be in prison at all. They're in prison for possession, so-called controlled substances. None of them should be there. Smoke a marijuana cigarette, they can put you in prison. Who ever heard of such a crazy thing? My God, smoke a Marlboro. Well, they'll encourage you to go out and buy more, and Marlboro will harm you more than marijuana ever will. But that's another story. Two-thirds of the prisoners are blacks or Latinos. Does that tell you something? If you're white and rich, chances are you're never going to end up in prison unless you really do something awfully, awfully bad. Even if you do, you've got to get caught before anyone will even dare to lay a hand on you. And what about the people in the prisons? I wrote an article called Political Prisons in America. In one section, I talk about modern-day slave labor. And I quoted the Left Business Observer saying that American prisons produce 100% of U.S. military helmets, ammunition belts, bulletproof vests, ID tags, shirts, pants, tents, bags, and canteens. They also supply 98% of equipment assembly services, 93% of paints and paintbrushes, 92% of stove assemblies, 46% of body armor. It goes on and on like this. These are prisoners. They do get paid for this. Very, very minor amounts. You know, pocket change to buy stuff at the canteen. Modern-day slave labor. America's gulag. And we have, depending on how you want to define political prisoners, the narrowest definition. There are hundreds of them. Ever hear a CNN report about this? Ever read a story in the New York Times about this? No, because they'd never print it. The article I wrote? My God, if a Times editor ever published it, he'd be fired. And they'd quickly delete my article from their archives so nobody could find it. So the narrowest definition, there are at least hundreds, and the broadest definition, there are many, many thousands. All the undocumented Latinos held in ICE prisons, I consider them political prisoners. And there are thousands of them, nameless, faceless people who committed no crime. There's a group called the Truth and Justice Foundation. They estimate that up to 15% of people in our prisons are wrongfully committed, and I think that's a gross underestimate. Because if you count all the people there for minor offenses, even if they committed anything, at most they should have gotten a reprimand and never put in a federal or state prison. That's an outrage. And again, we're talking about poor people, minorities. If a rich person did what they did, my God, even if it made the front page of the city newspaper, that rich person would never be put in a prison. At most, a reprimand, maybe a fine, and that's it, case closed. But if you're poor, think of the kind of justice poor people get in court. They court an expensive lawyer, so they get a court-appointed lawyer, low paid. They don't do any research. My God, I mean, they don't get paid enough to do this. So poor people get very poor representation, if they get any. The courts are stacked with right-wing judges. The prisons want to fill prison beds. Prisons are getting more privatized than ever. About 20 corporations, I believe, are involved in privatized prisons. Like privatized prisons, like privatized schools, the schools don't give a damn about teaching, and the prisons just the privatized prisons just want to fill beds. It's the only way they can grow their businesses. They need more bodies in beds. We call it our criminal justice system. I call it our criminal injustice system. That was a very long introduction. Let me introduce Irma Muniz, and we want to talk about her husband's case, Ramsey. Irma, I welcome you to the program. Forgive me for that long introduction. I really wanted to do it because I've had a number of programs on political prisoners, and I never went into this kind of introductory detail before. I felt it was high time I did it, and because your husband's case is so outrageous, I'm just livid thinking about it, and you've lived with it for 17 years, that I decided this was the time to do it. Irma, welcome.
Mr. Lenman, I cannot thank you enough for allowing me to be here on your show in the Progressive Radio Network, and your introduction was most appropriate because an issue like this merits very critical thinking, and thank you for having introduced this issue in the manner in which you have done.
Irma, it is an honor for me to have you on, and please call me Steve. Everybody calls me Steve.
Thank you.
Oh, your husband is such an extraordinary man. It is such an outrage. They should have pinned a medal on him, not prosecuted him, and put him away for life without parole. Talk about an outrage. I mean, the New York Times should have front-page features on stories like this. It demands that kind of attention. But discuss your husband's case and how he was framed and all this happened to him.
Let me start by saying that there is no question in the minds and hearts of many throughout the Southwest that my loving husband, by the way, that I love greatly, is in fact a political prisoner. All his life, he has advocated equality, education, justice, and freedom for all humanity. And truly, even after 16 and a half years of painful confinement, his writings continue to express that it is time for the masses of humanity to be free as it was meant to be from the beginning. That's a little bit of background, and now you ask me to talk about how he was framed, how he was wrongfully imprisoned. I will attempt to cover such a great history about this man in just a short period of time. You must know, he was, by the way, arrested in 1994 when he and I were married, and he was taken away. I don't know how else to put it other than to say that the government took him from me. Unexpectedly, he was on his way home from a business trip. You must know that Ramsey, this in 1994, 17 years ago, this was not the first time that this had happened to him. Because truly, his life changed at the height of his political career, which was back when he was a candidate for governor under a third political party in 1972, 1974, and then he was arrested in 1976. Quite shocking. And you mentioned a little bit earlier about things that you don't hear in the mainstream media, but truly what happens in the mainstream media is when it certainly is advantageous to those who are perhaps in power, they will in fact cover the stories, and they will do so through their perspectives. This man, along with many other students back in 1976, were following the democratic process to assert themselves, to try and become representatives for the voiceless, for those who had no representation. And it was in 1976 that, oh, by the way, my husband back then was an attorney. an attorney who not only really thought about himself, truly this was a time during the civil rights movement, during the Chicano civil rights movement. And one would certainly could characterize him as being an attorney who, from time to time, when there was abuse inside the jails, he would make his way into the jails publicly and demand to see people who were being mistreated. So he was at the forefront defending people. And suddenly in 1976, there were clients of his that got into trouble, and they got clients to state in trial that my husband certainly knew and was a part of all of this drug distribution. That was the essence of the case. As a matter of fact, his attorney then was Dick DeGaron, and he stated basically this was nothing more than people that were guilty of crimes pointing fingers, something that we know happens. It happens even today in our judicial system. What happened after that is that he became aware, Ramsey did, that truly what the government wanted was to be very lenient on him if he were to disclose the names of members of the political party. The name of the party was called the Raza Unida, which translated means united race. You see, he was helping the people that had no economic backing, as I mentioned earlier, had no voice, fought for jobs, fought for equal education, and so forth. These students were to be admired, as today we admire people, for example, in third political parties, such as the Green Party, people that are following the democratic process to bring about change. And when Ramsey became aware of the deals that they wanted to make in order so that to make it easier on him, that was when it was his deciding point to plead guilty and to become the sole culprit, the only culprit, to say nothing and to go off and do his time. I ask myself, how many people under such circumstances, under such tumultuous times, would have done the same thing? This was a very, very, I guess, it would have been something very threatening to me, and I can only imagine what was going through his mind. He pleaded guilty, and yes, he did leave for Mexico. He left from Mexico, pleaded guilty, knowing that there was no way he was ever going to get really a fair trial. He knew the climate during the civil rights movement. And it was, in fact, a very difficult one. There were people that lost their lives. There were all kinds of emotions, people that wanted change. And so he left for Mexico, and what he thought he was running from was actually, in fact, what happened. The authorities caught up with him in Mexico. He was tortured, brought back to face trial across the border, to face trial here in the United States. And so, if there are people that say he ran, why did he run? If comments such as that are made, these are perhaps comments from people that lack perspective, that lack empathy. Because I, on the other hand, and many people certainly that understand and know this man, would certainly look at it from a different view and say, what a courageous man this was. What a dignified thing he did. And what happened to him after that certainly has changed his life for the better, never for the worst, because he is absolutely a most beautiful, beautiful man. You must know, I will mention one other thing, is that when he came out, he was constantly being pursued. Pursued is not the right word. Being watched, let's say. Because it just seems to me that erroneously, the government believes that once you have been in prison, you are some type of enemy. And truly, that's not at all what it is, because there are many, many beautiful people that are incarcerated. That's as true a statement as saying that there are many people that are horrible that are out here free. So one must never make the generalization especially people that perhaps are in government positions, that just because one is incarcerated, he is an enemy. And I think that's one of the terrible things that happens in this country and perhaps in every country, is that once you have been incarcerated, convicted, your information is made public to the people that are in government positions, correct? Not necessarily people out here, but there are people that run the government. And I say all of this because after he came out of prison, and I must tell you, he was a legal assistant because, of course, he was disbarred after he had become arrested in 1976. He came out and did the only work that he knew how to do, and that was to continue to work in the legal system. But he was still watched, and little did he know that even again there would be another incident in Houston, an incident in which he was visiting a client to see if he could help find the right attorney to help represent that client. And in one instance in Houston, as he was visiting with a client, the strangest thing happens. He is in somebody's home, and then suddenly law enforcement makes their way in there. The client that he was visiting had basically just said, if you will excuse me, I need to go get something. I'm coming right back. I'm going to go to the grocery store right around the corner. I'm coming back. And all this happens again. Nothing was caught on my husband, and a very, very tiny, tiny, so they say, minuscule amount of cocaine was caught somewhere up on top of this person's closet. And so they tell my husband that if he does not plead guilty, that they are going to state that this person said that he was trying to sell this and do this and do this. The strangest things have happened since he was freed. The point I'm trying to make about Houston is this. It was an illegal search and seizure. That same attorney that had represented him in 1976 fought it in court and won. He was never convicted of anything in Houston because it was an illegal search and seizure. But I want to point this out to straighten in the minds of people that say, oh, well, my goodness, he must be a repeat offender. This happened in 1976. This happened in Houston, which was around 1982. The man never learned his lesson. When really people need to understand that there is always something else to the story, and that if this information is not actually sought from the actual person that it has happened to, there's a great lack of perspective. There is a great lack of information. And I must say that that has certainly been the point for many, many years. That brings me now to 1994. By then, I am married to my husband. I have been married to Ramsey since 1985. And in 1994 was number three. He was on his way home, by the way. And I will mention this. Throughout the 10 years that we had been married prior to this 1994 incident, he and I were very happy. We were always together. He was very much a family man. My family loves him greatly. They communicate with him. He communicates with them. So here we have been married for 10 beautiful years, and then suddenly he's taken away, and I get a phone call from him stating that something terrible has happened and he has been imprisoned. I will tell you this, that from the time that he was first arrested till perhaps the end of his trial, he really didn't know what had happened. They slowly had to figure this out during the trial with the little bit of testimony that was given by the government. I'll tell you a little bit about the 1994 case. My husband was in Houston and then traveled to Dallas. He was, again, visiting with clients, helping other attorneys. He couldn't represent them, but he was trying to help the clients decide what attorneys they could go seek their help from. And on his trip in 1994, One of the clients that he was visiting with was a person by the name of Donacio Medina, who was looking for an attorney to help him have his brothers transferred from prisons who were here in the United States. They needed to go back to prisons in Mexico. Ramsey was helping him find the right attorney, spoke to Dick DeGaren, who was getting ready to be hired by this man. Little did Ramsey know, he visited this man in Houston, and then Ramsey is in Dallas visiting with other clients, who, by the way, these other clients all came and testified at his trial to state that, yes, Ramsey had visited them during his travels, and that they had this kind of case they were discussing and that kind of case that they were discussing. So we did everything possible to prove, and we did prove, that his business was all legitimate. I'm getting back to my story then about Donacio Medina. What my husband didn't know is that he was being sought, and he had actually been arrested in Houston before he went and caught up with Ramsey to talk to him once again in Dallas. So Ramsey was visiting clients in Houston and in Dallas. So this man, Medina, visits him in Houston and then catches up with him in Dallas. What Ramsey didn't know then, nor throughout the trial, is that the government actually arrested him, caught up with him in Houston, because he, and only he, had made a drug deal with them. But you see, now I go back to my story about he now mentions to them that he's been getting help from Ramsey. We're putting two and two together, so that he could determine the right attorney to go see, and then they look into their system and they say, we know exactly who we want in this case. And without explanation in court, without fully disclosing who this man is in front of the jury, they let him go. So they let go the man they were after. The government lets go the man who had drugs in his possession when he was caught, and instead they come and place blame on Ramsey.
Let me interrupt you there. If you could hold your thought, we will take a short break to the bottom of the hour and then pick it up in the second half of the program. So if you can remember where you left off, you could pick it right up there when we come back.
I'll do it.
We will be right back.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Elaine Snuffa, host producer of Evolving Ideas. Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and global on the Internet. Join me each week on the Progressive Radio Network to explore the universe and our relationship to it.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
This is an emergency. No, it isn't. It's an urgency. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com with a new show called News Dissector. It's built on the blog that I do every day for MediaChannel.org, dissecting news, analyzing what's happening in the world, offering very cool music and great guests. Thursdays, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Be there for B-Square.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hey,
Welcome back. On with Irma Muniz, talking about her husband, Ramsey. It's a long case. It's gone on for almost 17 years, and the part of it that hit me the hardest was the episode that happened with Ramsey in 1994. And Irma, I know you're telling that story now, including how cocaine was. And I'll let you tell the story. How something on the order of $800,000 worth of cocaine was planted in a rental car by this other gentleman who asked Ramsey to drive it back, apparently to turn it in at a rental office. And out of courtesy, he did it. But let me let you pick up and tell that story.
Yes, absolutely. This man, Donacio Medina, is on his way leaving Dallas after having met with my husband, Ramsey. And he's being driven to the airport, and he's coming back to Dallas. And he tells Ramsey, would you do me a favor? I've decided to change motels. And I would like, if you would, move my car to this other one. It's right down the street. And when I come back, that's where I'm going to be staying. And Ramsey didn't have his own car then. He says, sure, I'll be glad to move the car. That's exactly the way this started. He's driving his car. And it's not even 3 miles down the road where he's going to move the car. And suddenly he knows he's being followed. He can see it from the rear view mirror. And he feels something is terribly wrong. He can sense it. This is a man that has been in the hardest prisons, that's had the biggest experiences anybody could ever have with the judicial system. So he parks there at the motel and is suddenly being surrounded by vehicles. And by that time, of course, his heart is pounding. He gets out of the car, and as he's briskly walking to find a telephone so that he can call an attorney and say something's wrong here, I don't know what the deal is, his mind is rushing, and he knows there's something wrong with that car. He's a very, very intelligent man. He's not stupid. He's walking quicker and quicker to try and get to a telephone. And he, as he is racing, he realizes that he's got the key to the car. And quickly he's saying to himself, I'm going to be stopped, I know it, and I'm trying to decide what to do with these keys. He knows that if he hands it to the authorities, because people are surrounding him, by the way, they have guns, he knows that if he gives them the keys, he's giving them permission to search something that's very terribly wrong. He knows he can't throw the keys, because if he throws them, he's showing culpability. So he was really trapped when he was being pursued unexpectedly. So as he's running, as he's walking briskly toward the telephone, of course he never makes it. He's definitely caught. Just prior to that time, he does the only thing that his mind told him he could have done. He puts those keys in his sock, hoping that they wouldn't find them. He certainly was trying to disassociate himself from a car he had just been asked to move. He had never been in that car before. They opened the trunk and found what they knew was going to already be there. Maybe, the cocaine. There were no fingerprints of my husband's anywhere in the car, anywhere on the cocaine. And the very act alone of having put the keys in his sock, which they found, is what got him imprisoned. There were no guns in this setup. There were no people. It was only him. It was him and another man that had driven Ramsey to Houston and to Dallas because Ramsey's got back problems. He typically would have a friend that he would ride with rather than doing his own driving because he's had knee problems. He's had back problems that date back many, many years. And so that's exactly the way this whole case came down, and they threw him in prison and to await trial. I'd like to now describe what happens in the trial, because surely you would think, well, if a man is innocent, he's going to be able to prove his innocence. Well, one would think so. But there's a difference when you're able to prove fairly. Let me give you an example about fairness. The criminal complaint that was submitted to justify that stop when he moved that car was made by a DEA agent, and this woman basically stated in the criminal complaint that they went after him because he was acting suspiciously in the lobby where he was staying before all of this happened. Well, we were finally able to find the motel employees because for a while they were nowhere to be found as the trial was going on. And all of them stated the same thing. There was nothing suspicious about this man. And by the way, the DEA agent had also said that that's why they contacted me. Well, the motel employees, none of them had contacted the DEA. And you can see this in the transcript. So that wasn't true either. She further on went on to say that Ramsey had signed his name incorrectly. He had used a different name, which is typical of drug dealers. Well, later they found out actually that wasn't true either, that it was one of the motel employees that incorrectly rewrote his name. And so the reasons that they used to stop him were all wrong. They were all false. The other thing I would like to mention is that he never even knew who was guilty of anything until the end of the trial, because there is something called Brady material. People in the legal profession understand what Brady material is, and the government has to come up with everything they have in the beginning so that the defendants can know, you know, what exactly are they being tried for. Well, this Brady material was certainly not submitted until the end of the trial. And we found out at the end of the trial, when the government finally disclosed a piece of paper to Ramsey's attorney and to Ramsey, that, yes, there was a man named Donacio Medina. And that's when they finally understood what really had happened, and that this man, Donacio Medina, had made a drug deal in Houston. Didn't have Ramsey's name anywhere on that report. It was Donacio Medina. Now, you see, so how is it that somebody is able to get a fair trial? How is it that somebody can defend himself under those circumstances? In essence, our attorney proved that all of the calls were legitimate, because they were also saying that Ramsey had made phone calls to drug dealers from that motel. Our attorney got those phone records and justified every single one of those phone numbers with the people that went to testify and said, yes, this was me. And finally turned around to the judge and said, which is the one that you're saying is an illegal phone call? And their response was, we don't have to tell you. So my point to you, Mr. Lenman, is that things aren't always what they seem to be. And yes, perhaps Ramsey is somebody that has been repeatedly in the judicial system, in trouble, in the prison system, but there are reasons for everything. And once people hear that other perspective and gain an understanding, then that's when things start to change.
You know something, Irma, what you say, I understand it very well from my writing on so many other political prisoners. The authorities, they have a menu of techniques that they use, including the charges that they levy. Very often they do a sting against the target. Well, they certainly did a sting against Ramsey. I mean, imagine planting cocaine, the small amount in a closet, I suspect that was planted there as well. Certainly the cocaine in the trunk of the car that Ramsey was driving, that was planted there by the authorities. All they needed to do was get him behind the wheel, and they had him. They had him. They were right there. They had him. So getting into that car and behind the wheel, they nailed their guy. In other cases I've written about, some of the charges against the people convicted on these charges was so preposterous, Irma. One example I wrote about, a so-called Fort Dix Five case, five innocent young men up in the New Jersey area near Philadelphia. They were accused of waging war against the army on Fort Dix, if you can imagine this.
Yes.
And they were set up. There was a sting. They did absolutely nothing, but they were accused. There was a government plant that led them on, and all they did was they used I forget the name of the weapon. They used to go up into the Pocono Mountains to do some kind of target practice with some kind of a gun that was not a bullet shooting gun, but another type of gun, a pinball or something like that. And it was over a year ago that I wrote that article, I believe. And they claimed that these people were casing Fort Dix, which happened to be the base that I was taken to when I went in the Army, Irma.
Yes.
Back in 1956, summer of 1956, I spent a few days at Fort Dix before heading off to Fort Hood. My memories of that were not that pleasant, but that's another story.
Well, I won't comment on that.
Can you imagine waging war on the U.S. Army? There was another man that I wrote about who was accused of trying to buy a missile to shoot down an airplane with, I believe, a Pakistani dignitary on board. Buy a missile to shoot down an aircraft. There were others in Newburgh, New York, accused of something very, very comparable to that, wanting to shoot down, among other crimes that they were charged with, get hold of some kind of weapons to target U.S. military aircraft and also bomb, I believe, a synagogue and bomb other buildings. There was some Haitians down in Miami accused of wanting to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago. They probably never had been to Chicago, and also blow up the FBI building in Miami. That was one case where two juries would not convict these young men. So what does the Justice Department do? When they want to nail somebody, I believe they were hung juries both times. A hung jury, you can go back and refile the same charges. Double jeopardy prevents doing that if a jury acquits. If a jury acquits, they come up with new charges and go after these people. Well, on the third try, after two failures, they got these guys convicted. They were completely innocent. And then they go after lawyers. Last week, we discussed the case of Paul Berggren, a very effective a former prosecutor in New Jersey, who was defending U.S. soldiers bogusly charged with a crime in Iraq.
Yes.
Whatever was done, the commanders were responsible for. These young soldiers were doing what everybody else in Iraq and Afghanistan does. They follow orders. Well, something came out. It was an Iron Triangle incident in Iraq, and four of them, I believe, were bogusly charged. One got off easy for giving evidence against the others, minor charges. I was just visited this morning for the second time by the mother of one of the soldiers imprisoned. He never should have been in prison, doing hard time in federal prison. 18-year sentence he got, an 18-year sentence. Well, Paul Berggren, the lawyer, was defending one or more of these soldiers, and he knew the people responsible. He wanted the commander to testify. He wanted to go up the chain of command in the Pentagon. He wanted to go after Donald Rumsfeld. He wanted to go after George Bush, because they're the ones responsible for waging these illegal wars, deciding how they'll be fought. Well, you know, the Pentagon plan is to decide how they're going to be fought. But part of the plan is to target civilians. This is standard procedure going back to World War II, at least, I think a long ways back before that, but egregiously in World War II and all the wars after that.
Yes.
So the ordinary soldiers, you know, you're in the ranks. I know what it's like to be in the Army. You damn well better follow orders or you'll get yourself in a peck of trouble. Well, that's all these young kids did. And they end up in federal prison. Paul Berggren wanted the real criminals held accountable. Well, they ended up going after him. His trial hasn't happened yet, but he's been charged with an array of very serious crimes, including conspiracy to commit murder. They want to put him away for life. Lynn Stewart, who was on my program twice. She's now in New York City jail, sentenced to 10 years in imprisonment after an initial sentence appeal went back to district court. An initial 28 month sentence was raised to 10 years for a 70-year-old woman who's guilty of nothing, who's ill, she'll never survive. It's a death penalty. A glorious woman. They should build a statue to Lynn Stewart in New York. Instead, they have her in jail. They'll be transferring her to a federal prison. This goes on and on and on repeatedly, Irma, and against people like your husband.
You know, Mr. Lindman, excuse me for interrupting, but your accounts of other political prisoners tell me that truly imprisonment, and especially political prisoners, affect people from all walks of life in all different types of circumstances. And that's why people certainly need to have a little empathy and a little understanding into the way these issues, these circumstances come about. It amazes me to hear the variety of the cases that you yourself have described. And my heart goes out to all of those people.
You're all
because
innocent,
I know,
Irma.
That's
exactly the real problem. They are all innocent, and I think I'm getting close to 40 individuals I've written about. There is not one single person who is guilty. They were all framed by one means or another, and they never should be in prison, but they are. And this is an indictment of the way this country is run. And let me make one other point, too. There is no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, and anyone saying we should lean to the Democrats because we don't want those bad Republicans, they don't know what they're talking about. I have a tagline I've used in articles, and I say, the criminal class in Washington is bipartisan, and it doesn't matter if it's George Bush or Barack Obama, it's the same thing. The same illegal wars, the same targeting people to put them in prison for crimes they never committed. Obama is just as bad as George Bush on all of this, on taking care of the corporate interest or stiff-arming the people who elected him. It goes right down the line. And your husband himself said, Irma, that he never voted for a Democrat or a Republican, and the first time he voted was for himself when he ran for governor. He was a smart man.
That perhaps is what makes him so unique. You know, he has always maintained his political beliefs from the time that he was a child. He's a very unique man, and truly, he has always believed that we as a people must have and build our own political power. So very much, you're right. He believes in one having their own political party. When he was with the Raza Unida party, these were students that were following the democratic process to build their own political party. He has never parted from that philosophy. I failed to say something about my husband that I find most important to share with the public. And you mentioned the word a while ago, double jeopardy. I will tell you that Ramsey is in prison for 3 strikes. In fact, I want to say he was perhaps the 7th person in this whole country to be incarcerated under this 3 strikes law. The fact of the matter is, however, I'm talking going back to that very first case in 1976. They tried him twice. They indicted him twice for the same incident. The first indictment was in San Antonio. The second one was in Corpus Christi, Texas. Same incident, same defendants. When he was certainly being sentenced, and by the way, when he decided on that first case to plead guilty and to do his time so that he himself would be the only person accountable, that he did this under a plea agreement. Hello?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know what that is. Irma, just continue.
He just did this under a plea agreement. They said, I'll tell you what, if in fact you plead guilty, which he did, so that he could go away and take the whole blame, they said, we will definitely take those 2 cases, because we know that he was indicted both in San Antonio and in Corpus Christi, and we are going to certainly treat them as one, which in fact they really were one. The prosecuting attorney agreed, Ramsey agreed, and we have just a little bit of written evidence to even show that. Now here we are in 1994. He's caught, and they said, oh, no, this is counted as two separate incidents. So there are your three strikes. Your 1994 and the two being the one being counted as two in the 1976 issue. So I cannot thank you enough for allowing me to speak about my husband and to give you an idea as to why he's the political prisoner that he is today. You know, the painful suffering of his incarceration for a crime he did not commit, has now become a national issue of human rights and freedom. And since his return to Texas, we have a national committee to free Ramsey that has been organized throughout the Southwest. Many have brought the idea that if necessary, it would be our legal intentions to take this issue to an international level. How much longer must my husband suffer? He's 67 years old. How much longer must a man who is falsely imprisoned remain there? You state that both Democrat and Republicans are the same, and yes, in so many instances they are. I have hope that our president, President Barack Obama, will do something about this. President Bush did not. We submitted a commutation of sentence to President Bush at the same time that we are trying to reopen this case and prove his innocence in court. It did not work. He did not pardon Ramsey, even though he pardoned others. We are asking President Barack Obama for an immediate commutation of sentence for a man who we can prove was innocent. We have submitted in this commutation of sentence the actual trial testimony that proves what happened and how they concealed the evidence of the actual culprit. We pray that Barack Obama, President Obama, will take all of this into consideration and will also understand that my husband is a good man. His conduct in the prisons has never been a bad conduct. He's a very peaceful man. In fact, Ramsey's never done a violent thing in his life. He is a man that loves humanity. He tries to help people. He's been like that since he was in junior high school, being a defender of the people that perhaps had no voice. And so I just want to tell you that I ask people that are listening to your show to help me, because I believe, like I want to believe, that our current president is different. I also believe that there are people out there that are good people, even our government representatives. I want to believe that. And that even though people may not publicly say, yes, I'm going to help you, that they do just do it because now they understand. And so I make this public appeal because I want my husband to come home. And I am doing everything to bring him home. He deserves to be back with his family, where we will resume our lives once again as contributing members of society, and we will be able to use our experiences to help others.
You know, Irma, I said what you're saying now, what you're doing is crucial to keep doing. No matter how many setbacks, it's crucial to keep doing this. And as I said goodbye to the mother of this soldier this morning before the program, she's trying to reach a retired three-star general about her son's case, a man directly involved. I think he was the commander of the army or the I guess it was the army of which his son's unit was a part in Iraq, and now he's retired. And I said, you have to keep after this. Find him, and you can probably Google a Pentagon database. I'm sure they know where a retired three-star general is, And if you can find out where he is, see if you can make direct contact with him. It's possible that he can help you. Well, these are the things that you have to do. And if you do enough of this, this is the way results are gotten. I've over the years, I've read so many stories about amazing things that happened because people worked hard enough for them over a long enough period of time that they accomplished what, if they didn't put that much effort into it, they never could have accomplished. So I encourage you to keep at this, Irma. I invite you back on this program anytime to talk more about Ramsey, his current situation and so on. And I absolutely want to help him any way that I can.
I can't thank you enough, and I will end with one quote from my husband, Ramsey, who says, "If freedom is a possibility for me from the prisons of America, it is only true God-given freedom if it is a possibility for all humanity."
Oh, that's wonderful. And, of course, in my article, I quoted him some of what I found was so eloquent, so moving, I wanted to include it in my article. He really is an extraordinary man, and you sent me a couple of pictures. You sent me one picture of the two of you together, and I saw a couple of others. He's an amazing man, an extraordinary man. And, you know, what does it say about a country that calls itself a democracy, and we take the best that we have, I mean literally the best that we have, and this is what we do to them, and yet the ones who are the worst, those are the ones they build statues to, Irma. And the politicians who should be the ones that are behind bars, and the generals who wage illegal wars and murder many, many thousands, millions of people. And we've done this for so many years. These are the people we put up on pedestals. But the best in society are the ones that we target and we harm. What kind of a country is this? Oh, we're at the end of the program, Irma. I thank you so much for coming on. I mean it very sincerely that you're welcome back on this program anytime.
And we will do it. Thank you so much for the opportunity, Mr. Irma.
And when you see Ramsey, please give him my best.
I will do. Thank you.
Thank you, Irma.
Bye.
And join us next week, every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. You're always going to get programs like this. Key topics, important guests, in-depth discussions, the kind of information you never get you-know-where, I don't have to tell you. Why waste your time with that? This isn't the only good program. There are lots of good programs on Progressive Radio Network alone. It's why it's the most popular online, what shall I call it, news and information service? A variety of programs with vital information on all kinds of vital topics, with wonderful hosts, and I'm proud to be a part of it, and I'm proud that this program is popular. This is the kind of programming people need to listen to know what's going on, and then defend ourselves. It's our lives, it's our interests. If we don't take care of ourselves, who will? So I like to end by saying, make this a regular habit.